Welcome to the Kitchen Counter Podcast, episode 121, Smorgasbord, October 2018. Hey everybody, thank you so much for downloading and listening to this episode of the show. I'm Roger, your host, and this is the podcast that's all about home cooking, getting in the kitchen, having more fun, making delicious food for your family and friends. Well, today's episode is a smorgasbord episode. And if you've listened to the show in the past, I do these occasionally when I don't really have one particular topic that's going to take up a whole podcast episode to talk about. So I like to tackle several smaller topics in one episode and kind of jump around a bit. We'll cover quite a few things in this episode today. So some of the things I'm going to be talking about today on the show, I want to mention something about the LaCroix sparkling water lawsuit that just came out a day or two ago. You may have heard something about that. I have a new podcast recommendation for you. A couple of comments from listeners about past topics that I want to share, and some questions that have come in as well that I want to tackle on this show. So we're going to be jumping around a little bit, talking about a variety of things. So hopefully you won't get lulled into any boredom as I drone on and on about one particular thing. We'll do a lot here. But before I get into all of that, of course, I want to mention a couple of things. First, I always ask if you want to get a hold of me, if you want to say hello, or if you have a question for the show, super easy to get a hold of. The easiest way to do it would be just to send me an email over to feedback@kitchencounterpodcast.com. I read all my emails. I respond to everybody. Occasionally, I'll bring some email stuff up on the show. But I love to hear from listeners to find out what you like or don't like about the show, what you want to hear more of, and just chat and tell me a little bit about yourself. Another way you can get in contact with me is heading over to the Facebook page at facebook.com/kitchencounterpodcast, or of course the new Facebook group that I've made for the show, The Kitchen Counter Coffee Break. That's another great place to reach me and other listeners for that matter. We always have some sort of an interesting sharing of dishes or asking questions or passing tips back and forth over in the group. And you can get over to that by going to kitchencounterpodcast.com/group. You know, and one other thing I want to mention really quickly about the group, which I think is kind of fun, is we hold monthly cooking challenges in the Facebook group. And I can't remember if I've mentioned this on any recent episodes or not, but every month I seek feedback from the group members on what kind of a cooking challenge we want to hold. And a cooking challenge is sort of an optional thing that group members can participate in. It's not required. It's not a competition per se. But for example, in September, the cooking challenge was soup, and one of the main ingredients had to be a root vegetable of some sort. So folks were having a lot of fun, I think, coming up with ideas on soup recipes or riffing on existing recipes or just trying recipes for the first time, you know, making soup and sharing pictures. And it was a lot of fun. And what I did last time in September is I actually did a cookbook giveaway in the group. Everybody who submitted a challenge or participated in the challenge, their name went into a mixing bowl appropriately enough. And I drew out a name and sent a cookbook out to the winner. This month for October 2018, we have a cooking challenge. It's a little bit different because it's October and it's the season of spookiness, of course. The cooking challenge is actually almost wide open. Folks can choose what style of dish, what ingredients they want in the recipe, with one condition. They have to choose either an ingredient or a style of cooking or a recipe or something that scares them, that they've either been quote unquote afraid to try in the past, or maybe an ingredient that they don't know if they like or not, but haven't been very excited to try it, or just a really challenging recipe that they've never attempted. For me, one example always pops to mind is eggplant. I'm not a big eggplant fan. I've never really found a recipe that I like eggplant in. I've never had good luck going out to restaurants and ordering anything with eggplant. Of course, I don't do it that much because I don't really like it. But this is the type of challenge where I might say, okay, how could I figure out a way to use eggplant in a way that I like it? Or it could just be a type of recipe, a style of dish that seems intimidating and frightening that they've never tried before and they want to give it a shot. So that's the October cooking challenge over in the Facebook Kitchen Counter Coffee Break group. If you're interested, again, head over to kitchencounterpodcast.com/group, ask to join, you'll get right in. And you can participate in the challenge and all of the other fun chatting and things that happen over there. All right, with that, let's go ahead and jump into the topics for the October 2018 Smorgasbord episode. Well, the first thing I want to talk about just briefly, and I'll keep it brief because I don't want to get all preachy on you, is this recent class action lawsuit against LaCroix sparkling water. You all know LaCroix. They're in the real bright, colorful cans. I love LaCroix, full disclosure. I drank it a lot. I think it's a good product. Anyway, this class action lawsuit was filed a few days ago. And let me just read something really quick from cbsnews.com. And I'll put links for this in the show notes, by the way. So anything I talk about in today's episode, you can find over at kitchencounterpodcast.com/121. You'll get to the show notes. But this is from cbsnews.com. This is by Amy Peachy. I think I'm pronouncing her name right, from October 5th. 2018 headline, LaCroix ingredients lawsuit alleges all natural claim is false. And then let me just read a couple lines here from the beginning of the article. LaCroix sparkling water is facing a lawsuit alleging its claims of all natural and 100% natural are misleading because of artificial ingredients. Quote, testing reveals that LaCroix contains a number of artificial ingredients, including linalool, which is used in cockroach insecticide. End quote, claims a statement from Beaumont Costales, a law firm representing the plaintiff. Wow. Chemicals that are used in cockroach insecticides? That's pretty hardcore, LaCroix. I can't believe you have the gall to do that. Of course, I'm putting you on. I mean, this is so dumb. I hate reading articles like this. I hate hearing about stuff like this. You know, I'm very opinionated about stuff like this. I've gone on about this before. I think this is ridiculous. It's scaremongering. And it's so funny because I'm also going to link to an article from Popular Science, which basically goes through and does a takedown of what's known about the lawsuit. I don't know that there's a lot of information out there that's public just yet. This Popular Science article is by Neil Patel, and this was posted yesterday, which I'm not sure what that means on the internet. I guess October 5th as well, or October 4th. I'm not sure why it wouldn't just give me a date. But anyway, I'm recording this on October 5th, and it goes on to make a lot of salient points as can be made about practically all of these scary, you know, food headlines. Oh, coffee causes cancer. Oh, bacon is worse for you than cigarettes, et cetera, et cetera. And I'll just read a couple quick lines from this to illustrate one of my points. When you hear things like, oh my God, Subway uses yoga mats in their bread. It's just a sensational way to take ingredients out of context and make them sound worse than they are. So this chemical that is found in LaCroix water, linalool, I'm probably pronouncing that wrong, L-I-N-A-L-O-O-L. This is what Neil Patel says about it in the Popular Science article. Linalool is another additive used as a flavoring agent. It's, quote, naturally occurring, found within many different types of flowers and spice plants, including mints, scented herbs, laurels, and cinnamon. It is most definitely used in insecticides as well. That part is true, but that doesn't mean it's poisonous to humans. After all, we don't ban chocolate just because dogs can't eat it. The only real toxic effects linalool has been documented to inflict on humans are mild skin and eye irritation, namely from aerosolized forms of the chemical. That's pretty normal for a spicy substance. Anyway, I'm probably not doing any of this justice by just dipping my toe in, so to speak, and, commenting briefly on this. But I guess my takeaway here is, and you folks already know this, I'm sure, when you see these sensational food headlines, personally, it's distressing because I don't know why we have to make the act of eating and or drinking in this case or cooking food like so emotionally fraught with danger and perils. It's not that complicated. I mean, it's not that sinister. It just never is. And these efforts to sensationalize, whether it's from the Food Babe or class action lawsuits like this one against LaCroix, it's just I think when it boils down to it, this is my cynical side. I think it's just an effort to make money by scaring people into, buying their natural products or something, or settling a big lawsuit. Anyway, I'll get off the soapbox now. I know you guys don't want to listen to this podcast. Listen to me rant on and on about supposedly scary food stuff. So we'll leave the LaCroix lawsuit there. Again, if you want some information, I'll put a couple of links over in the show notes for you to take a look at. But let's hop over to a different subject. I want to talk a little bit about a new podcast that was launched a few weeks ago in the food category. And it's a fun podcast. I've listened to most of the episodes. I think there's 4 or 5 episodes out now. But the episode is hosted by Nicole Schwagman. And she's actually a member of our Facebook group. And the podcast is called BFF with the Chef. And so in this podcast, Nicole interviews food bloggers, chefs, other food and cooking sorts of folks. I don't know how else to describe it. And they have all sorts of fun food related conversations. It's a very pleasant podcast. It's fun to listen to. If you like listening to people have conversations about food, casual conversations about food, I think this podcast would probably be right up your alley. So I would recommend you go check it out and just say hi to Nicole, see how you like it. And if you do like it, subscribe in Apple Podcasts or wherever else it is you get your podcast. Wherever you're listening to this podcast from, I'm sure you can find BFF with the Chef as well. My favorite episode of Nicole's podcast was actually, so far, her very first episode. She interviewed a gentleman named Ben Meyer of a blog called Ramshackle Pantry. And Ben Meyer's whole thing is he takes recipes, and he does a lot with cocktails and drink recipes as well, but he kind of digs into the history of the recipe in the dish and tries to recreate them or get to the source and make the original recipes. And he writes some really interesting blog posts about whatever it is that he's researching. So anyway, go check out BFF with the Chef over at bffwiththechef.com. And again, in the show notes, I'll include a link to that and a link to the podcast over on Apple Podcasts. So go check it out. So when I do my podcast episodes, I'll often get emails or Facebook messages from listeners who don't necessarily have a question, but just have comments that they want to make on something I said in the show, or they wanted to add a little extra information that they think other listeners might find interesting. And I'm a little delinquent on mentioning one of these, but I want to get it out there now because it is a really, really good tip. And this one, if I'm remembering right, came in based on a segment I did on a previous Smorgasbord episode back in July, episode 117. Of the show. And a listener had sent an email and asked what I thought the essential tools for a home cook were. And so I listed out several items that I thought were important: knives and thermometer and cookware and bakeware and all that sort of stuff. And I know I included like Amazon links, and I always mention that you should try to find like a local family business or something like that where you can buy this stuff from if you can. But I got an email from Bella M, and she had a great tip that I'm pretty sure I didn't mention in the episode, but it's really worth bringing up and sharing with people. And let me just read what she emailed to me regarding kitchen tools and gadgets. So Bella says, "I have every kitchen gadget known to man, and I have spent God knows how much money on these items. But what I've discovered is that for so many of these items, The local Salvation Army store is a wonderful resource. I've had great success. Cast iron pans, casserole pans, Pyrex, the occasional high-quality chef's knife, crock pot, different types of blenders, Nitro Bullet, Ninjas, Vitamix, and more. It's a great resource, especially for those on a budget. So yes, Bella, I 100% agree for a couple reasons. One, it is a great resource for people on a budget. Even if you're not on a budget and you're just looking for a really good deal, a lot of the things Bella mentions, like cast iron cookware, I mean, cast iron cookware doesn't really go bad. You might have to do a little work and apply a little elbow grease to get something back into cooking shape. But, you know, cast iron lasts forever. Same with Pyrex. Pyrex is pretty darn durable. And as long as it's not, you know, cracked or chipped or whatever, if you can find Pyrex bowls and dishes and stuff like that at a thrift shop like Goodwill or Salvation Army, they're probably going to be very reasonably priced. And they're going to be a great deal. Same with the cast iron. I've never found a good chef's knife at a place like that. I probably never really looked for a chef's knife there, but I'm sure you can find things like that too. And yeah, of course, appliances as well. And not only can they be a good deal, sometimes it's just really fun to hunt for stuff like that and to find a bargain. So Bella, thank you so much for that. I can't believe I didn't even mention anything like that on the episode, but you're absolutely right. Check out your thrift shops for, you know, those good quality, long-lasting cookware items and gadgets. So thank you very much. Now, I have another comment from a different episode. This was just my most recent episode on meal planning, which would have been episode 120, where I had dietitian Leah McGrath on, and we talked about meal planning and among other related topics. But again, something I hadn't thought of because I've never done it myself, and I haven't, so I didn't mention it in the episode. But over in the Facebook group, listener Catherine McCoy had a really great tip on meal planning, or not necessarily meal planning, but saving time as like a home cook and cooking for your family, a great tip for saving time. So this is what Catherine said. I'm just going to read this, her comment basically from the Facebook group. So Catherine said, "Love the new episode on meal planning. I wanted to share something that I do that has really helped me. I used to hate to go to the grocery store because I work full time and have two young kids, and it was a nightmare. Luckily, we've gotten online grocery ordering as an option in my town, and that has been a game changer. I make my meal list for the week and then make my order online. All I have to do is drive to the store and they bring my order out to me. Shopping this way, I don't forget anything and I'm able to stick to my budget easier. Most areas have the grocery pickup option now. I can't say enough good things about it. My meat and produce are always good and it saved me so much time. It's seriously a mom's best friend." This is really cool to read because you're right, Catherine. I think there's several places here in town that offer like the online grocery ordering. We're not talking like delivery where they bring it to your house, but where you go online, you pick out what you want to buy. I assume you pay for it online. And then somebody at the store goes and collects all this stuff for you. And it's funny because after I read this comment, I did my regular weekly grocery shopping. It was Sunday, and I was at our local Fred Meyer store, which is like a Kroger, you know, supermarket. It's got a huge store. It's got everything in it. And for the first time, I noticed, and I don't know if they've always been doing this, and I've just not been clued in, but there was actually somebody in a yellow t-shirt, like a store employee in a yellow t-shirt. And I think the t-shirt said, I don't know, probably, I think it just said like online ordering, or, you know, click here to order online or something like that. And she had a little like a Palm, God, I almost said a Palm Pilot. That dates me when it comes to technology. She had an iPhone and a list on it. And she clearly she was picking out produce when I saw her for somebody who had ordered online. And a couple of folks in comments to your initial post said, I think, I don't know if it was you or somebody said they use Walmart grocery, like a Walmart Supercenter. They do their grocery shopping online and pick it up. They said that they, if they're out of something you pick, they'll often substitute like the next larger or the next better item at the same price as what you originally ordered. So like if you ordered, quarter pound bag of, you know, shelled and chopped walnuts, and they didn't have it. They'd like throw in the half pound bag for free or something like that, which is pretty cool. I'm tempted myself to maybe pick a couple stores in town here, like maybe Safeway and Fred Meyer and maybe the Walmart, and do some online grocery shopping myself just so I can experience it. Maybe I'll share my results on the podcast. But anyway, so Catherine, thank you so much for sharing that. I think that's a great tip. And if it's an option for people, they should definitely give it a shot. And as far as cost goes, from what I was reading in the comments, most grocery stores either don't charge a fee to do this for you or charge a very, very minimal fee. I mean, we're talking a few bucks to do your online grocery shopping. So thanks for that, Catherine. Great tip. I'm telling you, the people in the Facebook group have got it going on. They are all over. There are some folks in there that, man, I learn something new practically every day. All right. Now, I've got a few questions that I've received from listeners over the past, it's been a while. Some of these are newer than others. But I want to tackle a few of them today. I've got more than I'm going to cover today, but I want to pick off a few for now, and I'll tackle some more in a future episode. And these are not in any particular order, but I'm going to start with question from listener Jerry Olofsson. And he sent me several questions, but the one I want to touch on today, it's actually an interesting question, and this probably could have its own podcast episode dedicated to it. But he asks, or this is a suggestion, he says, perhaps you can tackle mine and my wife's ever-long battle of what needs to be refrigerated and what doesn't. And then he lists off some examples: eggs, tomatoes, bread, butter, mustard and ketchup, soy sauce, Worcestershire sauce. This is a really interesting question, and I'm probably a terrible person to talk about this because I'm the type of person who will refrigerate things. Well, how do I say this? I always err on the side of like refrigeration and safety. So I'm more of a tend to refrigerate something if I think it's going to go bad and should be refrigerated than just leave it on the counter, it'll be fine type of a person. I've also mentioned before that I'm the type of person who religiously follows best buy or sell by or expiration dates on items. And that probably stems from like childhood trauma of going into our refrigerator and like grabbing the jar of mustard and the expiration date on it is like 3 years earlier than the current date. And I just remember my dad would be like, oh, it's fine. Just eat it. It's fine. And I swear everything in the fridge door was like that when I grew up. It seemed like anyway. But this whole question about refrigeration is interesting because I think at least in the United States and maybe Canada and maybe Europe, you know, I'm not as familiar obviously with those places. I think refrigeration tends to be common practice. I remember my first international trip and this doesn't count Canada. I went to Canada several times as a kid. So I'm sorry, my Canadian friends, I do consider you an international trip, but when I was a kid, it was so similar to me. I didn't really appreciate the differences like I do now as an adult. But the first time I got like, I would say like culture shock, let me put it that way, was I was just out of college, just working like a regular job for the first time. And I had a friend, a good friend that I've had known all my life, and he was in Mexico, in Oaxaca, and he was taking Spanish classes there, and he was down there for like the summer, and he said, hey, Roger, why don't you come down? I'm going to be finishing up. He gave me his date, and he said, when I'm done, you know, we can take like a week or a couple weeks or whatever, and we'll just travel around Mexico and check it out. I thought that sounded pretty cool, so yeah, I flew down to Mexico City, took a super long bus ride out to Oaxaca, met him and hung out. And we went, maybe the first or second day I was there, we went to the big market in town. And I can't think of the name of it, the Mercado. There's a special name for it. It's huge. It's a huge, bustling, loud, noisy, exhilarating place. It's an open air market, and it's got everything from textiles to souvenirs to you know, clothing, hardware, and then of course all sorts of food items. And I remember it was the first time I had ever really seen what I considered perishable food, just like hanging out in the open. And I'm thinking of meat and poultry in particular. I mean, there would be stalls and vendor stations in this huge market where there would just be chickens, like skin chickens stacked up on a countertop, just out in the open. I mean, it's not refrigerated, not in a glass case or anything. There would be, you know, chicharrones, fried pork skin, right? Pork rinds. They would have the fixins for those in the form of like whole pork skins, just like hanging on the wall. It just was crazy. And it was the first place I'd ever seen eggs not refrigerated. And then of course brings me back to one of your points here, Jerry. Do eggs need to be refrigerated? Well, come to find out, the answer is yes, and the answer is no. It just depends on where the eggs are, where you are, I guess, and how the eggs are handled. So for example, in places like the United States, certainly the United States, if you buy eggs commercially, you have to refrigerate your eggs because of the way the eggs are collected and processed. They're washed, which I guess, as I understand it, removes a protective layer called the cuticle from the outside of the egg, and it makes it more susceptible to salmonella penetrating the eggs or other nasty bacteria. So refrigerating the eggs inhibits that. Now, in places clearly like Mexico, and I even think like the UK, I think is different. I'm not sure about Canada. I'll have to find out. Their eggs are not put through that type of washing method. So it keeps the protective layer intact, and it's not as risky that salmonella is going to penetrate the shell of the egg. And so they'll leave their eggs unrefrigerated, and it's totally fine. And results, you know, food safety results from either method, they're both seemingly effective. So it doesn't really matter, it seems like, which way you do it, but you have to be consistent. So if you're in the United States, you do need to refrigerate your commercially bought eggs, because if you leave them out, they don't have that protective layer on the shell, and they could get salmonella. So eggs in the US, I would say, are definitely refrigerator worthy. The other things on your list here, bread, butter, mustard, ketchup. You know, I have another story. Let me just interject another quick anecdote. I swear I won't go on and on about this, but we went to, my wife and I went to St. John in the U.S. Virgin Islands for vacation. And like most places in the tropics, it's extremely humid. I mean, it's just boom. You could leave. Here's an example. We bought a bag of potato chips, like Lay's potato chips at the store. And yeah, they were like Lay's potato chips, crunchy. You bite into them, crunch, crunch, crunch. We left those potato chips, you know, we wrapped the bag up and clipped them or whatever. We put them on the countertop. And I think within an hour or maybe two at the most, they hadn't gone stale so much as they had gone like soggy. I don't know how to describe it. They just like lost their crunch. It was really weird. But what we learned is we had to put practically, when we bought bread, we had to put practically everything in the refrigerator, because the refrigerator actually, interestingly enough, seemed to prevent that from happening. Also in the tropics, you have to put a lot of stuff in the fridge because there's critters that'll get into it if you leave your food out on the counter, even if it doesn't need to be refrigerated. But I digress. So let me get back to you, to your list here. So bread, you don't need to refrigerate bread. I wouldn't refrigerate bread unless you don't plan on eating it right away. Putting your bread in the fridge, you know, you might get a few extra days out of it, but it's going to change the texture of the bread, probably not in a great way. So you don't need to refrigerate bread. Butter, another interesting one. You don't really need to refrigerate butter if you're going to eat it right away or within a few days. You can leave butter out on your countertop, you know, for a few days. A lot of people do that, so they have nice, soft, spreadable butter. it will go rancid. It will go bad if you leave it out too long, you know, more than a week probably. So if you don't plan on using all those sticks of butter right away, put them in your fridge. Even better, butter freezes really nicely. So you can throw your butter in the freezer and it'll last even longer. But yeah, butter, I refrigerate my butter just because I don't really need butter sitting around to spread on toast. And even if I do, I'll just take it out, you know, half an hour before, and it'll be fine. Mustard and ketchup. So this is good to know too. Most condiments you don't need to refrigerate. However, most commercially sold condiments in the U.S. are going to say refrigerate after opening. But like Heinz ketchup, French's yellow mustard, Worcestershire sauce, soy sauce, none of that stuff really needs to be refrigerated because the acid content in it is so high, or it's processed in a way that there's enough acid in it that nothing bad's going to grow in it. Now, it might not last as long. It might go stale or lose its flavor after a while. But, you know, you go to restaurants and you see, you know, I go to a barbecue place and they have ketchup bottles that sit on the countertop all the time. They never go in the refrigerator, I think. So you don't need to refrigerate that stuff. But like I said earlier, I always err on the side of refrigerating that sort of stuff. I don't really have any counter or cabinet space to put it in. So for me, the natural home is just in the fridge door. So those are just a few things, Jerry, that you mentioned on your list. The other thing I would say is a general rule is most fruits and most vegetables do not need to be refrigerated. With the one caveat is if you're not going to eat them within a few days, there are a few you could throw in the fridge. You know, your lettuce, your celery, peppers, things like that. If you have avocados you don't want to turn bad, you could throw them in the fridge and get a few more days out of them. Fruits like bananas don't need to be refrigerated, but if you're afraid they're going to go bad really fast, or if you live in a really warm, humid climate where they just turn in a day, you could certainly put them in your fridge. Tomatoes generally don't go in the fridge because it changes their texture. And a few other things you shouldn't refrigerate are things like onions and potatoes. They do not do well in the fridge. In fact, potatoes will actually transform in the fridge. Their starches will turn to sugar and they'll get kind of weird tasting. So those sorts of things you don't want to put in the fridge. So just a few ideas, Jerry. Hopefully I didn't rile any feathers or rock the boat in your wife and yours everlong battle of what needs to be refrigerated. So speaking of making food last, here is a question that came in from Monica Yeaton, and she had a question about garlic. She says in her email, a farmer in my area grows and sells the best garlic. My husband just brought home 7 pounds of it, about 30 heads. Its drawback is it doesn't store well and it won't last through hour-long winter. I live in Maine. In the past, with a smaller amount, I have roasted it, squeezed the cloves in a clean mason jar full of fresh olive oil and stored in fridge, and took a big spoonful of it when I needed garlic in something, which is almost everything. A quart jar almost full would last a month or so, and I never had a problem with this method until the last time I did it. After about 2 weeks, I went to use it, and funky black stuff was on the sides of the jar and surface. It went in the garbage. So can I use the same method, roast full heads in the oven with a drizzle of olive oil, salt, and pepper, squeeze into fresh olive oil, and either put it in smaller canning jars or maybe ice cube trays and freeze it? I'd love your idea on the best way to put up fresh garlic for use through fall and winter. Now, I've already corresponded with Monica. She hopefully had already done something with her garlic because it'd probably be too late now. She sent this a while back. But I want to make one comment. I don't think this is exactly what you were doing, Monica, but I think it's good for other people to know. When you take fresh herbs or even fresh vegetables, like, you know, you take cloves of garlic or fresh herbs from the garden, and you put it in olive oil. Now, you roasted yours first, but let's just say for the sake of this example, you're putting it in the olive oil raw. And some people do it because they like to infuse the olive oil with a flavor. That's kind of risky to do because I mentioned a few episodes ago on preserving food, I talked a little bit about botulism, for example. I mentioned that botulism is present on pretty much all vegetables, but it's inert. It's not dangerous because the spores haven't bloomed or whatever it is botulism does. But the thing about it is those spores will become active if the botulism can find a nice, reasonably warm environment that's free of oxygen and light, that botulism can grow. And something like a clove of garlic in a bottle of olive oil up in a kitchen cabinet is really, really ideal for botulism. So it can be dangerous. I do not recommend trying to preserve anything in olive oil. I'm not sure exactly how that works if you roast the garlic first, but it could be a similar thing. That could be why you ended up with nasty stuff in that one particular jar. So I gave Monica three ideas for how I would preserve garlic if I had a bunch of garlic and I wanted to put it up. The first thing I mentioned was that I would pickle it probably. Now, of course, when you pickle it, it's going to change the flavor, right? It's going to be more like a vinegary, a pickled clove of garlic. So you might not be able to use it exactly how you would fresh raw garlic. But that being said, pickled garlic is pretty dang good just to eat, and I would have no problem munching it down. I would not feel like the garlic was wasted at all. I just have to find other garlic to cook with. And, you know, once you pickle garlic, it'll keep for a year. No problem if it's unopened. So that was one method I mentioned for the garlic. Monica also said something about freezing it, and that would be my second go-to way to deal with it. You could even roast it first, or you could just mince it up raw, put into ice cube trays, and then fill those trays with the garlic with olive oil, for example, and freeze that. And then you have a nice little cube of olive oil and garlic that you can throw into whatever it is you need it for when you're cooking. And that'll last several months in the freezer. And then my third idea for storing garlic would be to dehydrate it. So if you had access to a food dehydrator, and I think there's even ways you could do this in your oven on really low heat temperature, you could dehydrate it, turn it into, you know, like that dried garlic you get in the, like the Vietnamese restaurant or your rice dish, the dry crumbly garlic, or you could even powder it, make your own garlic powder. And of course that would keep for a really long time if you wanted to do something with your garlic that way. So those would be my three ideas: pickling it, freezing it, or dehydrating it. There's probably other things that other folks have done. And if they have ideas, I'd certainly love to hear about it. If you send an email over to feedback@kitchencounterpodcast.com, I'd take a look at that. So Monica, thank you very much for that question. I hope you have lots and lots of delicious garlic to get you through that long Maine winter that you're probably just seeing the very beginning inklings of here as we move into fall. Okay, last one I have time to tackle today comes from Ramakrishna, or RK as he signs it. And this one actually has to do with my meal planning episode again, the one that we just did, number 120 with Leah McGrath. So RK asks, I know you discuss meal planning on your podcast, but how do I make weekday meals easier? I go to the gym, and by the time I get home, it's 8 p.m. And RK gives me a few options, and he wants me to give my opinion on these. So one option would be that he cooks twice in a week, once on Sunday, once on Wednesday. Prepping some stuff for Wednesday may save some time, but not sure how prepped food will stay fresh for 3 days. And when he means cooking on Sunday and Wednesday, he means making enough food on Sunday and Wednesday to last the other 5 days of the week as well. Another option would be to cook for the whole week on the weekend and freeze a meal or two for Wednesday or Friday. What are some dishes that freeze well? He says, I would think soups and curries, etc. And then his last scenario is to cook each night by using prepped veggies from the freezer or buying them. This will make fresh meals every day, but I'm not sure how I can save any time. Maybe prepped food with a good meal plan will make this faster. Well, RK, there are certainly pros and cons to each of these three ways of doing things. And I think you kind of mentioned them yourself in your questions when it comes to time and freshness and things like that. I'll make a couple of assumptions because I don't know exactly your situation, but I'm going to assume that you're only cooking for one or two. You don't have a whole family to feed, I'm guessing, if you're not cooking until 8 p.m. So I'm going to assume it's just yourself or you and one other person. If you're absolutely committed to making your own food for dinner every night, 7 nights a week, and your schedule's really, really full, you may want to think about the variety of things that you eat. I'm not saying it can't be done if you want to cook a different dish every night. Totally doable. It just might take a lot more planning, a lot more prepping, a little more creative use of your time. But what I'm getting at is I know some people that they'll make a meal. In fact, I know somebody that makes a meal at the beginning of the week, a gigantic batch of a particular dish, and then they eat that basically all week. You know, they just reuse it. They might throw in a few things here and there to add variety each night, but they'll make a big basic batch of like lentils or beans or chicken or whatever, and they'll eat that all week. And it's not like they're eating something new and exciting every night, but they're certainly getting good nourishing meals every night. Again, by maybe adding a few things here and there just to give it a little bit of variety. But if you're okay with eating leftovers, and I don't mean leftovers like you make 7 different meals and you're just heating them up. I mean, literally eating leftovers, eating the same curry 3 days in a row, that'd save you a ton of time. And, you know, stuff like that will stay in the fridge for 3 days, no problem. Now, if that's not really your thing, and if I were you, of your 3 scenarios, I would probably choose to cook twice in a week, like on Sunday and Wednesday, like you mentioned, because I think that's a really good balance of, you know, spending enough time cooking where you can make a few different meals for the week. You might eat leftovers a couple of times, but making a few different meals for the week, but you're not cooking every night. Maybe you're just using your microwave or you're just heating something up in the oven. And you could certainly use your freezer as well, but if you're cooking a couple of times a week, you're spacing it out in a way that you probably wouldn't really need to use the freezer, which then would save you time heating your meals up during the weeknights, you know, when you get home late. The other thing I would say is, you know, also look at the complexity of the dishes you make. I mentioned variety a minute ago, but, you know, complexity can be a killer when it comes to spending time in the kitchen. So if you're making very complicated soups and curry dishes and dishes with, you know, 20 ingredients, which could be easy to do if you find things that are delicious and you like to make, that can really eat into your time, right? So I would recommend really looking for recipes. I don't want to be cliche, but, you know, the 5 ingredients or less, or just the recipes that don't require a lot of prep of many different things. And don't require you to source and prep a lot of different ingredients and then do a lot of different assembly steps. You know, one pot meals are great for this sort of a scenario because you don't have to, that don't take, you know, 20 ingredients, 6 different steps in a couple of hours. You know, look for the meals that you can throw into a crock pot or a pressure cooker. They get cooked and then they're done. Also look for, if you're like a protein eater, if you like to eat like a main protein with your sides, you know, look for proteins that you can make that will last for several meals. So I've mentioned before, one of my favorite things to do is to grab a chicken or two and roast a couple of whole chickens. And then I've basically got chicken to eat for the rest of the week. And then I can assemble all sorts of different meals to go with roasted chicken, right? I can make tacos and wraps. I could make soups. I could make a frittata, quesadilla. I could, you know, you could do practically anything. You just eat them with some potatoes and green beans. So I'm just kind of rambling on here with ideas, but of the scenarios that you mentioned, it seems to me like maybe cooking twice in a week is the right balance. But, you know, that's just me, but I hope that gives you some food for thought, RK. And if you have any other questions, of course, send them back my way and we'll tackle them. So thank you for sending that in. Mm-hmm. Well, that does it for another episode of the Kitchen Counter Podcast. I hope you got some nugget of wisdom somewhere buried inside of that smorgasbord episode. I know I covered a lot of topics, but these are fun to do because sometimes my attention deficit disorder doesn't allow me to think about a topic for an hour, but being able to jump around and tackle several different things is kind of fun. I hope you thought so too. Well, just to give you a heads up on a couple things that are in the works, I mentioned a pizza episode. I'm still working on it. I'm doing a lot of research. It's taking a long time to get that thing put together. But another episode I have coming out really soon, the folks that are joining the Facebook group, I asked them what it is they want to learn more about when it comes to cooking and things like that. A surprising number of them have said they want to learn more about flavor and how to build flavor and how to make their foods more flavorful. So I'm putting together a whole episode just talking about flavor. Now, you know, I'm not a professional chef, so this is flavor from Roger's worldview, but I think it will help understand things all flavor related. You know, you watch cooking shows and these people say, I'm building layers of flavor. And what does that mean? Well, we're going to talk about that real soon. So stay tuned for that. And you know, you should go over to Apple Podcasts and subscribe to the show so you don't miss any upcoming episodes. All right, everybody. Well, like I said, that does it for another episode. Thank you so much for joining me. Happy fall. I'm so excited for this time of year when it comes to cooking. It's my favorite thing in the world. So I hope you find joy in your kitchen this fall as well. And until next time, happy cooking.